We'll call a meeting to order. This is State Government Finance Committee meeting for Thursday, March 10th, 2011. And we still are a couple short of a quorum, but we want to get started. Since we got pushed back on our start time, we have less time than we normally do for our committee. So we want to get started with that. We'll hold off on the minutes until we do have a quorum. And we have, first of all, today, Commissioner Spencer Kronk, the recently appointed new commissioner of Department of Administration. So, Commissioner, welcome, and you may proceed.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. Good morning, Mr. Chairman and committee members. For the record, I'm Spencer Kronk, Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Administration, and thank you for this time to present the governor's budget recommendations for our agency. Although I've been serving as commissioner for less than a month, I want to assure you that I and our department stand ready to further advance reform and innovation in state government. You'll find that the governor's budget recommendations support our work promoting shared business services and making better decisions through enterprise information systems. The recommendations also ensure essential funding of core operations that serve our customers across state government. The Department of Administration has a long-standing history of leading state government reform and innovation. Governor Harold Stassen created the department in 1939 as part of a comprehensive effort to reform and professionalize state government administrative services. It is founded on the idea that we can use economies of scale, specialized services, and strong business management to get the best value from our government services. One recent example that speaks to these efforts involves changes that have been made in how we purchase goods and services for the state. These procurement reforms have been possible because of strategic sourcing techniques that we use, including aggregating demand through the development of enterprise or primary contracts for high-volume items such as computers, office supplies, food, and information technology services, negotiating throughout the contracting process to obtain better terms and conditions, including pricing, expanding buying power through cooperative purchasing programs, and streamlining the procurement process by delegating authority for small purchases to agencies. Minnesota was recently the subject of an extensive report by the Pew Center on states highlighting our groundbreaking, nation-leading procurement reforms, and also received an award for procurement excellence by the National Association of State Procurement Officials. We want to build on examples like this. Later in this presentation, we'll see other reform efforts that are currently underway, achieving efficiencies and cost savings for state government, including the Real Property Management Information System, which, among other benefits, will give the executive branch and legislature comprehensive information for data-driven funding decisions regarding capital improvements, asset preservations, space management, and maintenance. We'll also hear about our efforts we are undertaking to maximize the use of state-owned space. And finally, we'll provide examples from our immensely successful Lean program, improving government performance by eliminating wasteful processes. And as we go through the budget and our examples, I believe that you will see a continued focus on reform, innovation, and efficiency. We are always eager to work with the legislature and with agencies across state and local governments to find new ways to provide the best value for government services. So let me first provide you with an overview of the agency's current appropriations and proposed change items. You'll see on this slide that admin's overall budget in round numbers is proposed at $172.3 million for fiscal year 2012 and $172.4 million for fiscal year 2013, with a total of 476.6 FTEs in fiscal year 2012 and 478 FTEs in fiscal year 2013. Our general fund operating budget is only 6% of our total budget. In contrast, 84% of our budget in fiscal year 2012 and 86% in fiscal year 2013 are from fees we charge for our services through internal service and special revenue funds. The remaining 10% is largely in two budget categories, federal funds and pass-through grants. I'll take a minute to go through each of these categories. As I mentioned before, admin's general fund appropriation is 6% of our overall agency budget, just over $10 million in fiscal year 2012, falling to $9.9 million in fiscal year 2013. Current general fund appropriations to the department cover a wide array of core functions, again, all with the common goal of achieving greater coordination and efficiency in state services, leveraging every dollar. For example, I mentioned our procurement reforms before, and a key piece of the state's strategic sourcing initiative is to negotiate contracts for goods and services. In just over 4 years, the strategy has realized over $24 million in lower costs on an investment of $352,000. Additionally, because of this investment, more than 600 state employees now have the tools to effectively negotiate contracts to further contain costs for the state. The state's demographer's office is another example of a modest general fund appropriation that helped Minnesota achieve the second highest participation rate in the 2010 federal census. Their work may have well been the difference between Minnesota keeping or losing a congressional seat. One change item I'll mention here is that the governor's budget for the department recommends a 5% overall operating budget reduction. This reduction includes $126,000 in remaining funds from state recycling and office supply operations transferred back to the general fund for fiscal year 2012, a $70,000 reduction in the demographic center's census funding beginning in fiscal year 2013, and a $45,000 reduction in funding for the enterprise real property information system for fiscal year 2013, affecting the operating support but allows for completing the development of the system. This next slide simply shows a six-year trend of decreasing general fund operating budget support. In contrast to the general fund, fees for services that we provide fund most of our budget, 84% next year and 86% the following year. Some of these services include maintenance and operations for 22 state-owned buildings comprising 4.4 million square feet of space, property, and casualty insurance for nearly $11 billion in state assets, state employees, workers' compensation, and mail processing. Each fee-for-service business prepares an annual business plan to ensure that the rates admin charges for its products and services are set as close to break-even as possible. A typical business plan includes information on products and services, financial outlook and customer needs, a private sector rate comparison, and business assumptions. As in their private sector equivalents, the business goals and performances are reviewed quarterly, and these reviews inform and guide decision-making. It ensures operations are performing at peak efficiency. For example, last year, in response to the difficult economic climate, all of our businesses carefully analyzed actions they could take that would reduce expenses or increase sales with the net effect of providing relief to customers. As a result of this review, overall lease rates at admin-managed buildings will decrease 1.8% from fiscal year 2011 to fiscal year 2013. We also saw unchanged rates for property and casualty insurance, workers' compensation, central mail, and the state register, and a 3% decrease for existing vehicle leases. We saw $1.2 million in energy savings in buildings operated by the agency, as explained in our agency overview presentation earlier. And we reduced state agency lease expenses by $1 million. Again, these are tightly managed businesses that ensure that the state gets the most value out of every dollar it spends. The remaining 10% of our funding consists of federal funds that support the Governor's Council on Developmental Disabilities and the STAR program, which helps people acquire assistive technology. It includes pass-through general fund grants from the legislature for public broadcasting, in lieu of rents, which is appropriated to admin each year from the general fund to pay for plant management costs associated with the space for the state office building, the Capitol building, the governor's residence, and other ceremonial spaces. Miscellaneous grants such as federal grants for the geospatial information projects, and gifts such as donations of services and furnishings for the governor's residence. In addition to the 5% overall reduction I mentioned earlier, the governor's budget includes three change items for the Department of Administration: a $145,000 increase each year on our shared services program called SMART, transferring support staff functions from the Environmental Quality Board to the Pollution Control Agency, and to extend funding through existing agency contributions for the development of the state's enterprise real property system, which my colleague will talk about in her presentation in a minute. Admin Small Agency Resource Team, or SMART, is a shared service organization in which the department delivers consolidated and streamlined human resource and financial management services to small state agencies, boards, and commissions. A sampling of services includes processing financial, budgeting, and staffing transactions, budget assistance, purchasing, and labor relations advice. SMART received an initial funding of $250,000 in fiscal year 2008, and it's currently funded at slightly under that level. However, with continued budget reductions, many of the organizations that SMART can serve are increasingly unable to perform these complex activities and need assistance with understanding state policies and procedures and to fulfill legal requirements. SMART provides the expertise in these areas, permitting customers to focus ever more scarce resources on the core responsibilities and to ensure compliance with state laws and rules regarding personnel and financial matters. SMART tailors services to customers' needs through collaborative agreements that outline each party's duties and responsibilities, and further, the client retains authority and control over these decisions. SMART currently serves 15 small agencies, boards, and commissions, including the Campaign Finance Board, Indian Affairs Council, Minnesota State Council on Disability, and the Council on Black Minnesotans. The governor's proposal would allow us to expand the program to meet the increased demand, allowing these agencies to get their back office in order. The governor also recommends moving administrative and support staff from the Environmental Quality Board to the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Under this proposal, the EQB will retain its independent status, but will gain efficiencies and leverage expertise of personnel at both the EQB and PCA. In addition, the governor's proposal calls for a report to the legislature in January 2012 on the roles, responsibilities, and staffing of EQB. As I conclude, I just want to reemphasize that admin is here to help our state government by controlling the costs that agencies pay for our products and services and the goods and services they purchase from vendors. We improve the processes they use in delivering the services to citizens, and we make better informed decisions through data, research, knowledge, and expertise. To better illustrate the ways we are doing this, we would like to give you a closer look at three initiatives currently underway in admin that are reforming government. First will be our real property information system. Next, we will look at how we are reducing costs by utilizing vacated state-owned space and sharing that space across multiple agencies. And then we'll wrap up our presentation with Tom Bauman, who heads up our Lean program, improving performance in state business operations. Tom provided a brief view of his program as time ran out during our agency overview and is back to give you a more extensive look of this immensely successful program. Mr. Chair, with permission, I invite Nikki Giancola, Assistant Commissioner for Facilities Management, who will begin with a look at the state's enterprise real property system.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record, and if you'd please spell your name as well so that we make sure we have it right.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name for the record is Nikki Giancola. Last name is G as in George, I-A-N-C-O-L-A. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Facilities in the Department of Administration, and I'm happy to be here today to provide you all with an update on this really important reform initiative. Just by way of a little background for those of you that are new to the committee or unfamiliar with this topic, the project itself got its formal launch several years ago as a Drive to Excellence initiative. The big goal here was to make sure that we developed an enterprise view of the state's real property and the state's real property assets. A key point of the business case that supported the initiative was that the state lacked a single view of its real property assets, and that prior attempts to address the issue through either a condition audit on a singular basis, agency by agency, or land inventories, those were the couple things we had, they'd only yielded fragmented results, incomplete databases, and they were really insufficient for any kind of real decision making. Real property management, and what I mean by that is the rent, repair, maintenance, and planning that goes along with ownership of real property assets, was being handled in a singular way by 20 or more custodial control agencies within the state, making statewide budgeting and decision making very difficult, and it was very inconsistent. So we were in a position where we couldn't, for instance, identify unused or underutilized space. We couldn't forecast where the next asset preservation appropriation should go. Thank you. Or where financial investments would make the most sense. We couldn't identify assets that were getting at the end of their useful life or beyond their useful life. We couldn't identify maintenance and repair work that was being done and at what what cost, much less producing strategic facility plans for the buildings that all of the agencies were managing. So there was this huge gap in availability of objective and quantifiable data at a statewide level, and that was the core for this project. An executive order was issued by the governor directing the development and implementation of an enterprise facility management system that would be shared by the agencies and used to manage state real property assets to assist in better decision making. The objectives are as noted here. Again, it's to get our decision making at a data-driven level. It's to make more effective use of the space that we do have and identify opportunities for shrinking space, which will save money. It would offer a way to streamline the capital budgeting and planning process across the state, and it would allow us to shift to planned maintenance versus reactive maintenance. When you can plan your maintenance, you can plan for expenditures, you can plan to prioritize. All those things are going to save money and streamline processes for those that are managing these assets. And, you know, last but probably not least is the fact that a lot of the information that we are putting into the system is information that would have otherwise gone with people. A lot of our agencies were managing either on Blue Line or, you know, Access or Excel databases. A lot was in folks' heads, and the idea here is to capture that before people retire or move on to different positions. So it's a place to be able to house all that data. Again, the overarching goal here is to have an enterprise view of our state's real property. The visual that you have there is depicting this. Today you can see from this graphic that we have an enterprise governance structure for the state's real property. All agencies that have an ownership position in property are at the table helping make decisions about the system and real property governance. And we also have an enterprise database with common standards, formats, and policies. The before look was on the bottom there where everybody was fragmented. The new state here, this one view of the world concept is up at the top, and it's going to provide for space, work order, and condition assessment to be in one place in a consistent form and with the capacity to be able to report out either on a standard basis for a lot of the legislative type reports or on a query type basis for the agencies to help them better manage their assets. I believe that it's going to make it a whole lot easier for agencies such as MMB, admin, OET, the legislature to obtain this information that's necessary for better decision making, give them data to make that decision, and even into performance management and capital investments. When the system is fully populated with all of the data, we're in that process right now, the state will for the first time have an enterprise view of its real property. The status of the system.
Representative Kahn has a question.
Yes, I don't see anything on this about energy use. And I don't know if that's something you're monitoring. And then a side question is, do you look at what other states, the examples that other states are doing on this kind of data management?
Ms. Giancola?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, on the energy piece, the state has currently a separate way to track and manage energy. It's the B3 system, Buildings, Benchmarks, and Beyond. It's a state-owned database that's managed by the White Group, and agencies have the ability to enter all of their energy data from utility bills and different things, and we can pull information out of that on a statewide level. The goal here, this facility management system is about space, work order, condition assessment of assets, but we do hope that in the future we can integrate. These systems have the ability to integrate with other systems. We're hoping even for maybe an integration to SWIFT down the road to integrate financials. But that's the way we will pull in energy-related information. The tie here, though, is that when you can get a look at your space, when you can see how much you have, you can start to put the data around what you're spending and consuming on the energy side to the space side and do the what ifs. If I shrink the space by this much, I can reduce my cost per square foot by X cents or X dollars. There is a tie there, but right at the moment, the energy data isn't in this system. And on the piece about other states doing this, most other states do this. Some, I will admit, that we've researched, they do it still on a fragmented basis, but many of the states offer this through, like, their Department of Administration, where you have an enterprise repository of all of your facility data.
Well,
Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman and Dickie, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has an online portfolio management system using national weather data to compare energy uses based on consumption and square footage. And it seems to me this is, since we have the information as being inputted, it seems to me that this is something developed nationally, which I know the state of Utah, for example, is using this. And it seems to me that, that this is something that we should be looking at instead of every state developing their own, because they're looking at developing a 2-year baseline and then trying to look at improvements. And it seems to me that if we're joined in with something which other states are doing too, we're going to get much better information and going to be, and it ought to, there ought to be cost savings in doing that. So I know, and I'm just kind of surprised that with all this stuff that energy usage really doesn't seem to be integrated into looking at all of this space requirements and the kinds of things that we could be doing, particularly with our, you know, allegedly green initiatives that we're doing. So what? Did anyone ever look at this national database?
Ms. Giancola?
Mr. Chair and Representative Kahn, yes. I would tell you that the state's B3 system is somewhat equivalent to the EPA, the Energy Star tracking database. The B3 system was in place farther back than 6-10 years ago. I think the state was on kind of the front edge of this. The B3 system does take into account Minnesota weather-driven data. It now tracks, in the last couple of years, there's been the ability to produce emissions data out of that system. As to whether or not we join a national level system, that's a different question that I think we could entertain. We are familiar with that system, but the B3 system is in place. Agencies are using it. The data is there. If at some point we would switch systems, it would be a matter of migrating the data.
Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, can the agencies interconnect with each other? Can they access other agencies' information through this system? How integrated is it even as a total state system? Are all the separate boxes on your chart able to find out what someone else is doing?
Ms. Giancola.
Mr. Chair and Representative Kahn, at the moment, I believe that, as in our Arcabus system, when you get into these systems, it's password protected, and each agency has people that are assigned to that, and they get in. I have the ability to see across the state. Our Real Estate and Construction Services Department does, but agencies, I don't believe at the moment, are looking at one another's data in the B3 system.
Yes.
Representative Kahn.
I know you want to get on. One last point. If you're allowed to look at all of them, do you look for someone that's really doing a good job or something, or do you look at something that's gone down? Do you have a baseline and you look at someone that's deviated from that baseline or something, and can you point that out as an example to other agencies?
Ms. Giancola?
Ms. Chair and Representative Kahn, we could get that data. I'll admit that I am focused on admin data, the admin buildings, and our 4.5 million square feet, but it is possible to get that kind of information. It's really helpful for the agencies, though. They can see their trends by looking at this, and it's directly related to cost. The more they can take out of energy, the more they have to work with in their operations. So there is incentive there for them to be looking at this data. And most of the agencies are very active in B3. By the way, it's a public building system, too, so it's available for all public buildings to benchmark in.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Giancola. There's very few bright spots in a downturn economy, that's for certain, but I am aware of the fact that there is quite a bit of empty space, and there's a lot of effort to reform and downsize government. And I'm just wondering, do you have modeling for, if we were to change the size and the footprint, do you have modeling for making sure that when space becomes available, or that there is space available, that you can do an assessment of and I know that would have to be factored into the whole financial picture of whether it's a smart move or not, but do you have folks actually looking for potential space if something should come available or if something is available, to reduce our costs? It would be a matter of acquiring or renting or leasing or getting out of leases, but you have actively a program to make sure that we are always right-sized into the facility's needs.
Ms. Giancola?
Ms. Chair and Representative Benson, that is the point of this system. That is really what that's going to do for us. We are working in the Real Estate and Construction Services Division right now. We do work with agencies. We have a small core of staff that work with agencies either when a lease is coming due or we manage the 4.5 million square feet on the campus. We're always looking for that opportunity. Right now, our vacancy rate on the campus is, I think, less than 1%. It's like 0.12. So we're doing a great job here. As far as looking across the state, though, again, that's really the main point of this system. I'll have a visual here to show you. That's what we will be able to look at once the agencies have all their drawings and statistics in the system. And a visual is much better to deal with, much easier to deal with than just numbers on a page. So that is the goal.
Representative Benson. Yeah.
Do you have a sense that there are some real opportunities for us, given the vacancy rates and the like, and the system that you're talking about today?
Ms. Giancola.
Ms. Chair and Representative Benson, I do believe there are. I can't tell you today where they are, but just from the examples that our own real estate division has worked in, when they get in, they can visualize this, they can map out for agencies to state space guidelines, and many of them have not been in the guidelines because over time you grow, people leave, you just don't naturally give up space. When you can get in there and see it, and you can drive that down. And that really is our goal, is to focus on space utilization and state-owned buildings, and this tool will be an enormous help to us in doing that.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Giancola, I see in some of your agency profile that you are in charge of plant management and real estate and construction services for state facilities throughout. How much of what you do could overlap with what the CAP board does for the Capitol and the surrounding buildings? How much do you work with them, vice versa? How much is redundant? I mean, how much do you think that you could provide for them as far as your workforce that they have to basically find people to do, or is there a mutual agreement between the two? I mean, sometimes you're pretty exclusive. You say, well, I can't do that because it's their job. But in state government, I'm wondering if there's kind of a working relationship that, and I see you have so many different tiny little departments underneath you or divisions. You know, maybe incorporating the CAP board under you people would be a better place than having its own exclusivity. And I understand that the way it was set up in 67, that it was the legislature to have oversight. But we have oversight over you, too. So I'm just asking some questions about that.
Ms. Giancola?
Ms. Chair and Representative, we work very well with CAP board. They are housed right next door to us in the admin building. Their focus is zoning and planning and having a comprehensive plan for preserving the Capitol area. Which we implement that. You know, we have to work with them, and right now I know that they take advantage of several things within the admin building and with admin on shared services type basis and things like that. As far as fit, our role in administration is really around the maintenance and repair and capital improvements for buildings, and their mission really is around zoning and planning, but when it comes to the Capitol campus, we have to work together. Statutorily required besides, but we do work together.
Representative Anderson.
Well, John Anning, it does say here, though, that you are in charge of construction projects for the state. So I understand remodeling is part of that, too, but construction is a big part, and I just think that we're doing a big construction project over there, and it's a remodeling project on top of it, and they're kind of simultaneously, so just curious.
Members, you've heard me give this speech before, but I will reiterate it, and I've talked with Commissioner Cronk about this as well, and that is that we have a desperate need for a campus master plan that identifies the future needs and plans for our facilities here at the Capitol. The CAP board has very limited to do with that. And the Department of Administration has not really been given the authorization to do what needs to be done there. And so this is a continuing problem. What are the needs of the House, the Senate, all of the different offices here that are on the Capitol complex? What about moving some things that are off-site onto this campus so we have better potential for coordination and cooperation among various agencies? So I'm going to keep talking about this, and you will see some legislation on this too. So thank you. Ms. Giancola, do you have any further?
Just a couple of more slides. I wanted to be sure that you were aware that the name of the system that I've been talking about is Archibus. So if you hear that word, that is the application that we are using. We've installed 6 modules covering space management, building operations, building fixed assets, condition assessment, move management, and project management. Agencies have been entering their drawing data and cataloging their space. Some have started entering their actual equipment assets into the system. We've spent in the last year a significant amount of time, because this is an enterprise governance driven project. We've spent a lot of time on security issues, just making sure that we know what data is going into the system and that we are in compliance with enterprise security, that framework, as we're doing it, and that we are agreeing on recovery strategies. Each agency will have recovery strategies related to business continuation planning, and we need to make sure that all of the agencies that are on the system are in sync with the recovery strategy that we come up with. I just wanted to briefly talk about there are great benefits, as you can probably tell from what I've been saying, by approaching this on an enterprise-wide level. Time spent performing an analysis in multiple systems, different ways, different applications, is really inefficient. And it's risky. You're prone to error and inconsistency, and that was where we were previously. By developing the system around standards that all of us are adhering to, we're going to improve the efficiency and accuracy of the data entry. We're going to save time and increase efficiency in that way. A unified system reduces replication, which again is saving time. It reduces risk by having each agency handle their own security, for instance, in their own way. And it improves reliability, your ability to track and manage maintenance, repair, and work orders is, again, shifting away from that reactive role that we had been in more to a preventive role. So the return here is in efficiency and using technology here to our advantage. Just a little bit about operational benefits from an agency side. Again, Archibus provides agencies a place to store, analyze, and update their key building data. Once you have the data collected, you can then analyze it, and you can begin to forecast. And then once you can forecast, you can actually get at, you know what's going to come, you can start strategically planning. It also allows the agencies to be able to communicate intelligently within their own agency, objectively about risk and immediate, short, and long-term budgetary needs. And there's a potential for greater efficiency when you can consolidate work into larger chunks. And we will be able to do that once we know what we have and we can start planning and purchasing, for instance, on a statewide level. The condition assessment piece of this will allow the state to identify deficiencies in a consistent and objective manner, to develop budgets to correct the deficiencies, and then prioritize work for maybe one property over another based on physical condition, category of need, the amount of investment that's required, and the life cycle cost analysis. And then here, again, the concepts of being able to right-size your space very quickly, and space utilization is a key opportunity for us. Last slide is an example. This is a CAD drawing that represents computer-aided design of the Capitol, the basement of the Capitol. Accurate space drawings are the foundation of this system. Better utilization of space, again, is directly related to cost savings and cost containment, and more efficient layouts. When you can see this and you can lay out space in a more efficient way, it means savings. Just as an example, avoiding the need to provide just one 8x8 cubicle type space in a building that's average cost is $15 a square foot would save you close to $1,000 a year, and that adds up the more you can do that. So by utilizing Arquebus, and I will mention that four agencies have been on singular versions of this system for a number of years, they have had great success in driving down their cost. And the ability to integrate all this data has been an enormous help. My last comment here is related to the budget change item that you have. It's entitled Enterprise Real Property Contributions. A couple of years ago, there was a statutory fund set up whereby agencies contributed, and this proposal by the governor would amend that current law to permit the continued use of $399,000 in these contributed funds from agencies to support the system. The enterprise team has completed about 70% of the base drawings work, and continued use of this funding would allow us to finish that off and also fully comply with the security standards that we've been talking about for the project. So that concludes my update for real property.
Thank you. Representative Banyan.
Thank you, Chairman. Ms. Giancola, this looks very interesting to me, and I came in a little bit late, but so I might have missed you saying this before. If I wanted to see, you know, how this space was being used, if I wanted to see how much it cost, how does the public get to know anything about sort of the cost of the use of our real space? Is there going to be something out there that we could look at? This, you know, someone in the public could look at to say, here's how much the space is being used, and here's our cost per square foot. Is that kind of information going to be made available?
Ms. Giancola?
Mr. Chair and Representative, it will be. The one of the main pieces here is having all the data in one place will allow us to produce reports that very quickly get at that. The system itself is going to collect the data. It will do the factoring and the analyzing in terms of cost per square foot. Previously, we had just been requesting that information from each agency in a number of ways, and it was never a report that you could really get your arms around and do something with. This will produce meaningful reports and data.
Representative Banyan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just as a quick follow-up, I hope that would include then, as we need more space or different space, that gives information to people who might be able to provide that space to bid bid their commercial spaces to you to give you the ability to find us a good value.
Ms. Giancola?
Good point.
Okay. You're finished,
I am.
Ms. Giancola. Commissioner, we have about 10 minutes at most here to wrap up, given the other things we have to do.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to ask our next presenter, Dave Fielding, Director of Plan Management Division, to really tie into a number of things that were just presented into one way we're actually using this type of information.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dave Fielding, Director of Plant Management, and let's show you a real-life example of some of the things that we've been doing to try to achieve the savings that both Commissioner Cronk and Ms. Giancola talked about. I refer you to the map of the Capitol campus, and we talk often about the 22 buildings that we control. One of those buildings is a building called 321 Grove Street. It's just to the east of Expressway 35E. It's that red building you see off to the right. This is a warehouse facility of roughly 45,000 square feet. I'll also call your attention in this picture to the blue building, which is just to the lower right of that facility. That is a leased facility, which for many years has been the home of various functions of the Department of Human Services. And finally, over on back on the campus again, you'll see on the left side there the DOT building. And within that building on the first floor, same level as the cafeteria, is the central mail facility. So keep those geographically in mind. The 321 Grove facility roughly 18 months ago looked like this. The big yellow space was the office supply connection warehouse. This was when we administration performed the office supply procurement and distribution for state agencies. The blue area in the middle is resource recovery. And the balance of the functions there are essentially Department of Administration plant management activities. Over the course of the last 18 months, and I think we've talked about this to the committee at various times, the office supply connection operation was discontinued in December of 2009 and has been operated since that time by a third party. In addition, the Resource Recovery Center, which we talked about last year, ceased operations in the 321 Grove facility in September of last year and is now being performed by a third-party Accessibility, Inc. So as we see 321 Grove today, all of that crosshatched red area is vacant. We're down to less than 20% occupancy. This is a critical building for us. We perform the grounds maintenance. We have to have a location for that activity, for the ground equipment maintenance. In addition, this is the key location for the Department of Administration for our continuity of operations plan if there was a reason for us to have to vacate the administration building. So we've been hard at work trying to figure out how we can repopulate this building in a way that allows us to continue to maintain this facility and also satisfy other needs.
Mr. Fielding, if you'd hold just a moment. Representative Kahn, was your question to this witness?
Well, I'm not sure. I want to get back to the budget cut that's moving EQB out.
Can we hold on that?
Sure. I just want
Representative Winkler, is your question for Mr. Fielding?
It is. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Fielding, your discussion of the resource recovery unit brings to mind the end of the last legislative session when the administration was, I think, seeking authorization to outsource that particular office or that function, and that was not in the bill. It didn't happen. And so I was curious about, when I heard about that later, how that came to be if you didn't need the authorization to begin with.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the authorization that we were seeking at the time was in connection with a statute language for materials transfer. I think we suggested at that time that we might have to come back at a later point because of resource recovery and because of the economics, the failing economics associated with that. As it turned out, we had the ability within statute 16C.10 to contract for the services through Accessibility, Inc. because the waiver that we were seeking under 16C.09 did not come into play because Accessibility, Inc. is a certified rehabilitative services provider. So you're right, we talked about various issues that involved both materials transfer and resource recovery, but because of the bid and because of the successful bidder, we didn't have to pursue that any further.
Representative Winkler?
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, Mr. Fielding, I'll take a look at that language.
All right.
You may proceed.
All right. So as this picture shows now, this is the plan that we are proceeding with for 321 Grove. This is in design, and it's important to note the activities that we're that we found. There is a consolidation of the central mail operation in the Department of Transportation building. This is prime real estate for the DOT staff, and they have been pointing out to us that if we could free up this space, they have a need to create meeting and conference center opportunities for their staff. They're going off-site currently today to various locations when they have large meetings. So this way they'll be able to bring that back onto campus. At the same time, the Department of Human Services has a unit that's referred to as IOC, and that operation performs functions that are very similar to those that are performed by Central Mail. And we've felt for some time if we could co-locate those two operations that there ought to be synergies by doing that. Once those discussions began, then we found that, you know, I'll refer you back to that blue building that I showed you on the map. DHS, Department of Human Services, has two other functions, child support and their financial operation, that are in that building. When we put it all together, we get what you see here, which is a building, a 45,000 square foot building that has, at the current time, only about 2,500 square feet unaccounted for. So we can fill this building up, and we can do it in a way that benefits the Department of Transportation by moving Central Mail out of the DOT building, by bringing DHS over from the facility that they're currently in. We can achieve significant savings for them. If you look at this summary, all of the space that's occupied by all these functions today accounts for a little over 51,000 square feet in their current locations. When we bring them into 321 Grove, that drops to 40,000. That's a 22% reduction in total square footage. And when we run the numbers based on the projected cost of upgrading 321 Grove, moving everyone in the first 3 years, we will have saved the state over $1.4 million in rent. So this, I think, is an example of the kinds of savings that we can achieve when we have the information, when we're on top of the information and look for those opportunities. At the end of the presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Fielding. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Tom Bauman. I am the Lean Program Leader for the state of Minnesota. And thank you for having me back, and hopefully have a little more time to talk through some examples of the program and where it's working throughout state government. As I mentioned previously, the program began in late 2007. We are housed in the Department of Administration, but we work with all state agencies, all 24 cabinet-level state agencies. We've also tried to be very inclusive, to include counties in our training and our activities, cities as they're interested, and government agencies outside of just the cabinet-level entities, because we think process often goes where process goes. And to really understand and improve it, we need to be inclusive. And so I think that's been very beneficial. Our core approach has been to use lean tools, and I'll talk about that in a little more detail today. But we've also been inclusive for those people that understand and know Six Sigma or total quality management. There's a lot of overlap, a lot of similarities in those approaches as well. And so we've tried to be very inclusive because it's about process improvement and making processes more efficient. So the lean approach boils down, in its very simplest terms, it's about process improvement. We don't talk a lot about structure. We don't talk about restructuring organizations. Sometimes that's an outcome of our process improvement activities, but it's really about looking at how the work gets done, the step-by-step, day-to-day, how the work gets done. And we really focus in with the lean approach on trying to eliminate, reduce what they call non-value-added activities. And non-value-added equals waste. And I'll give you some examples of that in a minute. And the other key component of this is that we engage the people who do the work in making the changes. So it's not about the senior leadership making the changes in process. It's about the people, the frontline workers, who do the job every day, who are part of these process improvement events to identify and make these improvements. And the benefits are is that they really understand how the work is getting done. They understand the strengths and the weaknesses of the processes. And once they believe that they can make these improvements, they are the proponents. They are telling the senior leadership, we can do this, we can make these changes. And I think it's a powerful message. The lean approach really helps us to identify and figure out how to identify those non-value-add activities. And they categorize them in what they call the seven wastes. And those wastes are defects, extra processing, waiting, storage, overproduction, transportation, and motion. There's an extra one, and I'll mention that at the end. That's not a part of the official lean approach. And in case you're interested, lean has been around in some form or fashion since the 1920s. Some people refer to it as the Toyota Production System, or TPS, and they're probably most closely associated with developing this in the early 50s. So if someone said what this new lean thing is all about, it's only new if you think 95 years is new. The hardest part of this is that we can't see the waste. Waste is everywhere, and yet it's insidious. It's buried in our processes, in the work we do every day, and one of the biggest struggles we have is really trying to see it, to understand where it is, to remove it. And if you can't see it or understand it, you can't remove it. So we use the seven wastes to help us look at process, try to understand where it is, and then we can remove it. So let me give you a few examples, and I'd be glad to take questions as we go. Defects. In Minnesota state government and in most organizations, we spend tens of millions of dollars fixing defects. Our processes go back and reduce and remove defects, and you'll say, well, of course, we have to do that. And my comment or question back to our process improvement teams is, what can we do to try to reduce the number of defects that we're fixing in the first place? And let me give you an example that came out of the Department of Revenue. We just completed a process improvement event, or as we refer to them as Kaizen events, last week with a team of 15 people from the Department of Revenue. A little background, Department of Revenue mails out about 1 million pieces of mail every year. And last year they got 104,000 pieces of mail returned to them because the addresses were wrong. They then have a process by which they look up, discover what the right address is, and resend it. It costs them about $15 per return letter to do that. You do a quick math and it turns into something about $1.5 million to actually do that activity. So the goals of our Kaizen event was, first of all, to reduce the number of returned pieces of mail that comes back to the Department of Revenue, and secondly, to streamline the process by which they resend that mail to the right people. By doing this, we believe, and we've a whole series of steps were identified. They're going to begin implementing these process improvements over the next 90 days with a goal of having it in place by July 1 of this year. Their goal is, it's impossible to have 100% deliverability. But they believe by doing these steps, they'll go from about 89% to 96%. By doing that and by doing the other improvements that were identified by the team, they believe they'll save between $850,000 and $900,000 a year just in the resending of mail that they sent the first place. That's identifying defects. The other outcome of this, which speaks to the organizational structure part of it, this is a group of people that worked in five different divisions within the Department of Revenue, doing somewhat the same thing in each of the different divisions. At the end of it, this group of people decided that, you know what, to really become efficient, we need to have a consolidated mail resend unit, a mail unit and what they call locate. And they suggested to the senior leadership at the report out last Thursday that they create a consolidated mail unit within the Department of Revenue. It's form following function, and I think that's really where you see the people buy into it, understand it, and take action on it. And so that's one example. Extra processing. When we look at what we do within process, it's invariably that we're doing lots of things that we don't need to do or that would consider waste in a lean vernacular. I'll give you a recent example from the Department of Health, and it has to do with the health facility complaint intake unit within the Department of Health. By law, federal law, state law, healthcare facilities need to report when a patient or a family member has a complaint about the what's going on, either from what they believe is maltreatment or bad food or whatever the complaint is. They need, by law, to report those to the Department of Health. And they have an intake unit within the Department of Health that receives between 8,000 and 10,000 complaints every year. And so by law, there's to report these, and then this unit takes action, either decides that it's not, it can be resolved easily, or it needs to be investigated and followed through on. The statute, which is 626.557, requires the healthcare facility to report to the Department of Health. It also requires the healthcare facility to report it to the county health services office as well. And then it goes one step further and requires the county health services office to report that to the Department of Health, State Department of Health, which, if you think it through, results in a redundancy where people in the Department of Health intake unit are getting reports from the facility itself and the county itself. And I said, well, what happens when you get those duplicate reports from the counties? And they go, oh, we print them out and we shred them. 66,000 pieces of paper last year were printed out and shredded. It cost them about $95,000 a year to do that. A next waste is waiting for things to happen, waiting for decisions, waiting for various activities. An example we had related to the Department of Military Affairs and the Minnesota National Guard. In 2009, they had a situation, and this had to do with the enlisted personnel promotion process. People that are basically at the private corporal ranks being promoted up into the sergeant level. In 2009, it was taking them on average between 70 and 105 days to make any one promotion occur, and they had 700 vacant sergeant level positions waiting to be filled through this activity. They believed that that was simply not tenable and that they wanted to take action, so they did a Kaizen event around their promotion process. They identified and they looked through and they said, of all the things that we're doing to make any one promotion occur, what are those value-added activities that really have to be done in order to make the promotion happen? They identified 48 minutes of real work that had to be done in order to make the promotion happen. And yet they were taking between 70 days to 105 days to make a promotion. They instituted the changes in the process. They now do those promotions in 2 to 3 days. I can give you, we've done 185 different events in 18 different agencies. I can give you a lot of examples. One related to storage. Storage is a waste. We're saving, storing, archiving, tracking materials, and we need to understand why we're doing it. In DOT, we did a Kaizen event on their contracting process. And discovered, and they knew it was going on, and they had some reasons for doing it, they were saving empty envelopes that the contracts came into them for 3 years. They had file cabinet after file cabinet after file cabinet filled with empty envelopes. And there was a reason why they did that or thought they needed to do that, because some contractor had complained years and years ago that they had thought they got their bid in on time, and the postmark would bear that out, and for a variety of reasons, DOC says, well, we better save envelopes. So their record retention policy was, we'll save empty envelopes for 3 years, and like I said, they had file cabinets full. At the end of the Kaizen, they determined, we don't need to save empty envelopes anymore. It's costing us a tremendous amount of money in storage, keeping track of them, recycling them. We did an event recently with the Department of Human Services on their adoption records process. And these are just the part where we keep track of the records related to adoptions going on in Minnesota. They get the envelopes that the paperwork comes in on. They electronically scan the envelopes. They also save the envelopes. We can ask why, and we did, and we try to figure out there really was no purpose in any of that. So as part of the change in the process, they're going to eliminate the scanning and the saving of empty envelopes. And the last one has, and I can give you many examples, Department of Public Safety with the vehicle titling process. They do a million vehicle title transfers a year. When they get the paperwork in, they scan the paperwork into an electronic system, and then their retention policy was that we'd save the paper for 7 years. They have a warehouse full of 7 years worth, or did, worth of 7 years of title transfer paperwork, even though they had electronic files of that same paperwork. The other waste that I mentioned, and here again, there's examples of this in all the processes that we see. This is not exclusive domain of the public sector. The private sector struggles with process waste throughout, and so we have great opportunity, but we don't have the exclusive domain as well. The other ones are overproduction, transportation, and motion. So we use these tools to help us really see, understand, identify, and remove waste from our process. The last one, which is not really a key component of, or it's a key component, but it's not one of the official seven wastes, is this idea of the not utilizing the knowledge, experience, and just the mental acuity of the people that work for us to really identify and remove waste. We often leave it at the doorstep of the senior leaders to do that, and they simply can't see it. They're not close enough to the work every day to understand the wastes and the extra steps in the process. So really engaging the workforce in making these changes is a key tenet and a key benefit of the lean approach. So I showed you these statistics before, and they continue to hold. By applying these identifying waste and removing waste from process, we see an average of 66% reduction in elapsed time, a 45% reduction in task time, the actual work that needs to get done. I heard a fellow from Cold Spring Granite Company talk about lean, and he made the comment that they've been doing lean in Cold Spring for 15 years. And he said, we made a commitment to our staff that we were going to stop doing the stupid stuff. And he said, we look at our process and we decide what is we have to do, and let's stop doing the stupid stuff. Now, I don't care to use those terms here, but that shows you their commitment to trying to really look hard at that individual activity. We save on average of about $90,000 per event. Some are dramatically higher, some not nearly that high, but on average. We're one of three states in the nation that have an enterprise level, and when I finish up here, I'm going to go back and have a teleconference with a state representative from the state of Washington who wants to introduce legislation in their state to copy the Minnesota program. So it's a program that makes sense, I think, especially from an enterprise perspective, and there's lots of cities and states that are interested in doing the same thing. The one thing I will caution you or say up front, that lean, as they say, is a journey. It's not a quick fix. It's not something that you can say, well, we're done with that, let's move on to the next thing. Toyota's been doing lean for 65 years. Companies that are serious about this make a long-term commitment to see it through. But if you do that, you see tremendous benefits over time.
Mr. Bauman, thank you very much. you're on the right track. Representative Kahn.
I'm not sure where this fits in the presentation, but I'm really concerned, particularly with the passage of the bill, one of the bills that we've just passed, House File 1, about moving the EQB. You know, I guess I'm one of the few people who were around when the EQB was formed, and was distinctly one of the reasons it was put in administration is because of its representation from all of the other action agencies. So I'm concerned about moving that to PCA, and also the reduction then in, you know, when it looks as if that bill will probably cause, will need more analysis of the kinds of things that come before it. So I'd like some comment on that decision.
Sure.
Mr. Bauman, or Commissioner?
Whoever.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn. Just to repeat what I said in the presentation, that the administrative and independent status of the EQB will remain as it is. It is an independent agency. It will just be housed in PCA. The support services that are helping guide the EQB will just be used from PCA. It's more of a relocation than anything else.
Well,
Representative Kahn.
Why does this need statutory? What statutory change does this need then? Why does this need a statutory change if it's not a functional change?
Mm-hmm. I can't, Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, I'm not prepared to answer that right now, but I can get back to you on that.
Okay.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you go through your audits and you find the kinds of various things that you've spoken to this morning, are you developing an administrative support manual to lend guidance to retention periods and some of this stuff so across agencies the whole state government can begin looking at, we found this here, it's probably going on there, and here's guidance, permanent guidance to say, you throw this stuff away, you don't keep that. Anything like that going on?
Mr. Bowman?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Benson, no, we haven't, and I think what we've really, the truth of the matter is that every process is different. Every situation is different. As you really dig into it, some of these things are driven by federal law, and we understand that. Others are in state statute. We always encourage teams to challenge that, and I say this with just slightly a tongue-in-cheek, but I say the folks that gather in these rooms are changing statute all the time, and if we have good ideas on changes to statute that we may believe are useful to our state and to our, that agency, that we should bring them to people like you to help them talk this through and hopefully try to understand whether it's value added. I don't think there's a one-size-fits-all guideline that can be used, but we do talk about retention schedules as being, we need to be thoughtful about how long do we really need them, or do we do it as a way to cover our backside, which we have a tendency to do as well.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, just as a living document, as a resource guide on a website, it would be prudent to have, you know, so the next new manager doesn't come in and said, well, you know, we used to keep envelopes. Why aren't we keeping envelopes? You know, just so that it would be some permanent record of this is the stuff we found and it led to waste as a retention. And it's a rhetorical question. You don't have to answer it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, a keen observer of the presentation, this legislative process, noted that the seven kinds of wastes that you presented were exactly the legislative process. Waiting, defects, extra processing, overproduction, motion. But that was just an observation.
Good observation.
Which is to say that, you know, sometimes checks and balances aren't efficient, I guess. About 2 weeks ago, Representative Simon and I, along with Majority Leader Koch, Senator Ortman, Representative Lincheski, Senator Bonhoff, a big group of us got together out at General Mills and met with Ken Powell, the CEO, along with a number of other senior executives. And I know General Mills has been involved with the state in getting the lean process going and has been very generous in sharing their experience. And just for committee members to get a sense of it, General Mills, for a long time, could count on pretty stable commodity prices. And so they could produce cereal and make a profit, and they didn't have to think too much about it. But as commodity prices have started to go up and they see no end in sight, they realize they are going to have to bring costs out of their operations in order to continue to make margins that they need. And so they've brought, through the lean process, they've saved $1 billion a year from their operations, which is, and they were in the presentation saying, you know, not that $1 billion a year would really make any difference to the state of Minnesota. Anyway, that was interesting. But one thing that we learned from Ken Powell, the CEO that day, was the importance of not just of doing the lean process, but making the lean process part of the culture of the organization. And we've started, and we've got a great effort going in the state. But, you know, I guess my suggestion is that until the CEO of the state evaluates every single division head or commissioner on how much they have saved or how much they have dedicated to process improvement, you're not going to change the culture. It has to come straight from the top. You know, I had the sense in the last administration that Commissioner Badgero got this started, but it was new, and now is the time to really try to make this part of the administration's culture on an ongoing basis, so it is not, as you said, you know, you're not just on a journey, but you're actually creating the expectation all through the organization that this will happen. So I wonder if you, maybe Commissioner Kronk, you can comment on changes that are we might see, or, you know, steroids you might be injecting into the lean process for state government.
Sure.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler. The examples that we gave today clearly illustrate that the types of reforms and innovations and efficiencies that we're looking for have been incorporated into the DNA of admin. It is now, as you mentioned, up to both myself and the governor's office to really, and the legislature, to really champion these efforts throughout state government. It's only been 3 weeks since I've been on board, but I certainly look forward to working with you and with the governor's office to look at these examples and see how we can expand them and really incorporate this type of culture into all parts of our administration.
Representative Winkley.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Kroc, I guess maybe a more direct or pointed way would be, can you give us sort of a baseline of where we are now and how many of these Kaizen events or how much this is happening so that we can compare maybe in a year to see if it's really, you know, been amped up? Because, I just get the sense that this is happening. There's cooperation. There's some enthusiasm for it. But it's, you know, it's not like the Commissioner of Human Services wakes up every morning trying to figure out how she can use the lean process to make her agency more efficient. I mean, just as an example.
Sure.
And that's kind of where we need to get to. So I'm hoping you can give us some stats or some information to compare to in a year to see if we've expanded it.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, I'm going to defer to Tom to give that baseline stat, but we can also get back to you on the actual details from the past year so we have a baseline to work from for the coming year.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Winkler, you hit the nail on the head, and it's one of the key messages. Just as you mentioned, Ken Powell. Ken Powell is the CEO of a large company. He's also a Kaizen facilitator for the agency. So he is actually does one facilitation of a process improvement event each year, which sends a powerful message to his senior VPs to say, this is important. You better, you know, get on board. Leadership is key to sustain it over time. And I know Commissioner Kroc and I have had some conversations about how do we engage the 23 new commissioners that have been appointed to ensure that they do make time for improvement and identifying and making these changes over time. Because it's easy to kind of let this slide. It's not as urgent, but it's awfully important. So trying to carry that message from the governor's office to the commissioners, I think, is a vital step, and I think commissioners will ready to assist that. We did some training with General Mills with our past set of commissioners to help them understand and be supportive, and I think that was useful, but we need to continue that on. Just as a baseline, we've done, as I mentioned, we've done 185 events at this point in time. We're doing an average of about 60 a year across the state of Minnesota. If just to give you a point of perspective, Toyota Motor Company in their plant in Kentucky do 10,000 a year. If we're serious, we need to ratchet it up. The benefits are there, but it takes a commitment of time and energy to do it and to ensure that we implement and sustain the improvements over time.
Representative Kahn, and we need to move on. We've got some other business we have to conduct yet.
Just, I think another thing that's needed is certainly more publicity about events at the state. The specific example I know is I believe the Department of Administration did a computer replacement and put large numbers of people on laptops rather than desk computers to facilitate commuting, which something Representative McNamara and I have been working on trying to get here. And, you know, certainly this was not brought to our attention in the House, at least. I don't know about the Senate. Did a total replacement of their computers after this has been done, sticking with desktops. And there may be some reason for doing this, but there was never any discussion about it. So,
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, I couldn't agree with you more, and it's a key part of my tenure at the Department of Administration to be able to not only promote the successes that we've had, champion the efforts that we're undertaking, but also to market how we can do it with other agencies.
Thank you very much, Commissioner and Mr. Bauman. Members, we need to do our minutes. We have a bill to do, and I want to talk schedule, and so I hope you'll be able to stick around here until we're done, because we need to have some conversation about the schedule from here on out, given the fact that 2 weeks from tomorrow is our D-Day. let's take care of the minutes. Yesterday we ran over. We weren't able to do the minutes from the previous day, so would someone move the minutes from March 8th and March 9th?
So moved.
Moved by Representative Kahn. Any additions or corrections to those minutes? If not, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carried. They're approved. And I want to pay a special recognition to our committee legislative assistant, Ms. O'Neill. She has been very prompt in getting these minutes ready for the next meeting. And I've had, in my experience, we've had to wait sometimes weeks to get minutes. And so I think we should thank her for her prompt attention to those so that we don't have to come back and do that much later. The next item on the agenda is House File 886, and I would move this bill. We intend to lay this over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. What this bill does is what we've been doing the last three biennia. We have, as a legislature, authorized a grant from the lottery funds to support an effort to deal with gambling compulsion and to help people who have a problem with this. And so this bill would renew that grant for the next 2 years. And so we have a couple of folks here to present. Would you please identify yourself for the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I am Kathy Peralt. I am the executive director of the North Star Problem Gambling Alliance. I am on week three of the CRUD, so I apologize if I sound a little rough. I know that time is tight, but we really appreciate you taking time to look at our grant. We basically are continuing the work that has been going on with the North Star Alliance in the area of prevention, education, research on the topic of problem gambling. We prepared a handout for you. So at this point, I think it might be best if I just answer any questions you might have.
Any questions? Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Peralt. You hear a lot of talk about increasing gambling in the state of Minnesota. I mean, legislatively, whatever would be that increase. How do you think that impact the program that you're working with? Do you think that there's not enough gambling in Minnesota yet or not?
Ms. Peralt. Representative, Mr. Chairman, we don't really take a position one way or the other on whether there should be or should not be gambling. As our alliance works on the fact that if there is gambling, there will be problem gambling. I think we need to make an assumption that if we expand gambling in the state, we'll probably expand the problems along with it, and that's the kind of thing that we are here to work on. As long as there's been gambling, there's been problems, so I think that that's part of what the state wrestles with.
Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Don Feeney. I am the Research and Planning Director of the Minnesota State Lottery. I'm also a member of the Board of Directors of the North Star Alliance. Mr. Chairman, Representative Erdahl, one thing that I would like to point out in regards to that issue is that Dr. Rachel Volberg, who has done more studies on the prevalence of problem gambling than anyone else in the world and has done them worldwide, wrote a paper a few years ago where she came to the conclusion that one of the main things determining problem gambling rates was the presence of prevention, treatment, and education programs. Places that had programs in place had lower rates of problem gambling than places that do not. And that's why we're here.
Thank you. Representative Kahn.
Well, Mr. Chairman, first of all, I'm embarrassed because I signed on the bill. But there is a correction that's needed to the bill. I don't know if you need it by an amendment or not, but in line 111, we're saying complementary, and we mean complement. The I needs to be an E.
So. Mr. Shepard.
I don't know if you need to move that or what?
Mr. Shepard, do you have that?
Mr. Chair, yes.
I would incorporate that into. my bill.
Then the next point is the issue of the fact that, again, this comes from the lottery fund, but we've had specific, I think we've had some evidence that the lottery is the least contributor to the issue of problem gambling. I thought there's some evidence that problem gamblers don't tend to buy excessive lottery tickets and so forth. Is there any questions on how we could get discussions about how we could get contributions from other entities, or if we're increasing gambling in some way that's not related to the lottery? You know, I guess I haven't seen any specific budget programs yet, how money from whatever that increase is would go into this program.
Mr. Feeney?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn. Regarding the Alliance does receive contributions from several of the other forms of gambling. Canterbury Park has been very generous throughout the years. We have received contributions from several of the tribes and some of the charities who conduct charitable gambling, although they're in a tough financial spot. Certainly, if there is to be any expansion of gambling, there certainly could be a provision put into those bills to divert some of that money towards services for problem gamblers. As a representative of the state lottery, I'm neutral on that. As a board member of the Alliance, I fully support that.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Peralta, Mr. Feeney, I see that there is a national conference on problem gambling in Boston this June. I take it then there must be other similar type of nonprofits in states throughout, and I'm just wondering how many. Does every state have something like this to deal with this, or I suppose it's just those that are dealing with gambling situations? And what have you learned from other states as far as dealing with the situation?
Was that to Mr. Feeney, Representative?
Either one.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, I'm also on the board of directors of the National Council on Problem Gambling. There are, I believe, 33 or 34 states that have councils similar to this. There are some states with some substantial gambling that have no such council. There are councils in states where gambling activity is relatively minimal. Unusual in that regard. I have learned that Minnesota has some of the best services in the country. I'd say in the top five in terms of the services that we provide and the treatment that is available for problem gambling. There's some that are better, and that I think that that we can learn from. We've learned a tremendous amount about treatment advances that are being done in other parts of the country, and for that matter in other parts of the world. This is an issue on which the British, the Canadians, and I think the Australians are actually well ahead of anything that's being done in the U.S. There are some very interesting new approaches to treatment, some of which promise to be much more cost-effective than some of the things we're doing now, some of which may be more costly but more effective. It's a field that has grown tremendously in the past 20 years. We have learned a tremendous amount, and there's much more for us to still learn. I'd love to at some point go into that with you in some detail.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you. Mr. Feeney, what's the recidivism rate of that as far as people not going back into it after they've gotten help from you?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, it's a tough thing to measure. I haven't seen any really figures. I have a tremendous amount of confidence in that. It's on the par with other types of relatively chronic medical conditions. 40% is probably not a bad figure. It's high, but it's, you know, the same thing with people who don't take medications to manage their diabetes. It's certainly on a par with chemical dependency, alcoholism. Sometimes people have to go to treatment several times in order for it to work. And one of the things that we've learned is that one way to combat that is better aftercare services. It's a lot cheaper than sending someone through treatment a second time. It's something they don't do particularly well at this point.
Mr. Chair, one last question. And how does Minnesota rank as far as that? You said we're high in recidivism rate. How do we rank all nationwide?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, I have no idea. That figure I quoted to you was based on some national studies. We don't have a Minnesota-specific rate.
Thank you.
Representative Murphy, and then we need to conclude.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The appropriation, is this for the operation fund of the board?
Ms. Peralta?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the appropriation supports the activities of the North Star Problem Gambling Alliance as a nonprofit agency. So those funds are used for communications, outreach, research. The board of directors are volunteers, and the funding goes into our operating budget.
Thank you. Mr. Chair,
Representative Murphy.
Is there a geographical balance to what services are provided throughout the state?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we have a network across the state of professionals who are involved in various aspects of problem gambling treatment or prevention. We've got an established speakers network with people all around the state, about a dozen, and we do training and education and outreach everywhere. So we promote the availability of our speakers and our information, and we'll go to any part of the state. We also have representatives on our board from other parts of the state, and we travel as needed. So yes, I think that we do a fairly good job of covering the entire state, but it's also something we continue to strive to do better.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, one last question then. This is $225,000 per year, and that fits into a total budget of what?
Ms. Brawl?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, I would say that our total budget is somewhere around $275,000. So it does make up a large part of our operating budget right now. The other funding comes through contributions, as Mr. Feeney had said, from the different gambling entities. It also comes to us through in-kind donations of services. Recently, we have an Awareness Week activities going on where we've been able to get donations of services. As a nonprofit, we can get agencies to donate creative work, and we can get the billboard companies to donate. So right now it's a very large part of our operating budget. The other piece comes in from memberships of people that join as members of the alliance to support the organization, and one of our goals is to expand that base funding of our budget so that we can spread the dollars around and not be quite as dependent from any one location.
So, Mr. Chair, did I hear that this is three-quarters of their funding?
That's about what she said, yes. Yeah. Representative Gunther, folks, we have to...
Real quick one, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Feeney, you mentioned running ACES contributes often to gambling cessation programs. What other gambling venues in the state do that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gunther, I mentioned Canterbury Park, not running ACES.
Okay.
We have received contributions from several of the tribes. I don't know that I remember precisely which ones, and so I don't want to start on the list because I will get it wrong. We have received donations, as I mentioned, from a not insignificant number of the organizations who sponsor charitable gambling as well. Those have been small, but and of course,
members, I would renew the motion and lay this a bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you, Mr. Feeney and Ms. Pearl, for being here today.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, members of the committee.
Members, 2 weeks from tomorrow is our deadline, and. The ideal would be for us to mark up our bill on Thursday the 24th. And we are going to need at least one and maybe two meetings before that to hear testimony on the bill. And if we had testimony on Tuesday and on Wednesday and marked up the bill on Thursday, we're going to have this bill essentially put together by the end of next week, because we would want to have it be out on Monday so that people could see the bill and have an opportunity to weigh in on it. And if we're not able to mark this bill up on 2 weeks from today, we're going to have to hold over and meet as a committee after session on Thursday, 2 weeks from today, or Friday morning, the 26th. And so I would hope that we would be willing to try and get everything that we may want to consider in that bill out of this process or through the process next week, by next Friday, in order to have the bill ready to be distributed on the following Monday. Now, I had mentioned to Representative Kahn here a while back that I would welcome the opportunity to meet with the Minority Caucus. I would renew that offer. I'd like to be able to do that early next week. Maybe we can do it after we take care of the bills on Monday night or some other time. But I would like to have the opportunity to visit with the Minority Caucus about what you would like to see in this bill. So I want to extend that offer again. But in order to follow this schedule, we may need to have a meeting next Friday if we're going to follow this schedule. So I wanted to put all of that up to you, and then also remind you that on Monday we're scheduled to meet 30 minutes after session to take up a number of bills at that point. So, Representative Kahn, did you have a question?
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to point out that the reason I haven't tried to schedule that yet is that I didn't think it was useful until we saw what the targets were.
Okay.
So I understand we are going to see the House targets at 1:30 today.
Yeah.
And that will give us some information that we can start thinking about, and we'd be very happy to meet with you then.
Fair enough. So let's talk about scheduling a time. Members, we're adjourned.